Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio's new show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters will bring you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We aim to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire our listeners. Three hosts will alternate weekly shows to bring the listener a broad range of topics and expertise on environmental and conservation issues that affect us here in Grant County, around New Mexico, nationally, and globally. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I will be your host for today's program. The Gila Resources Information Project, also known as GRIP, is a nonprofit environmental organization that works to promote community health by protecting our environment and natural resources here in southwestern New Mexico. Our guest today is landscape photographer Michael Berman. A resident of San Lorenzo, New Mexico, Michael has been exploring this region for over 30 years and is fascinated by the land and how people use and value it, an interest that grew out of his studies in biology at Colorado College and work with James Enderson on peregrine falcons and his initial forays into landscape photography. He worked with the Peregrine Falcon Recovery Project from 1978 to 1982, and in 2008, he received a Guggenheim Fellowship to photograph the grasslands of the Chihuahuan Desert. Michael is a 2012 recipient of the New Mexico Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts. His work is included in collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Amon Carter Museum, and the New Mexico Museum of Art, among many. His installations, photographs, and paintings have been exhibited throughout the country, and his books include Sunshot, Peril and Wonder in the Gran Desierto, Inferno, and the new Gila, Radical Visions, The Enduring Silence, that was released during the 8th Annual Gila River Festival. Michael is a founding board member of the Gila Resources Information Project and is on the board of the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello.
Welcome to Earth Matters.
Thanks.
So you've been wandering the Southwest photographing the land for 30 years. Can you tell us how you landed here from where you grew up in New York City?
Yeah, when I went to high school, I kind of found I was rather adept at working the system, but didn't really feel like I always got the most out of school. And I had this idea I wanted to go to a college that was just a little bit different. So I actually applied to a school called Hampshire. It was the place I wanted to go. And if you know something about that school, it basically had no structure. You got to do whatever you wanted. You created your own course of study as well as your major. And the good thing was I got accepted there for the second semester, but I also applied to Colorado College. And what they had was you took one course at a time. It was something called the Block Plan. And it was also in Colorado, which, since I grew up back east, it was seemed kind of exotic. So I was lucky enough to go to Colorado College. And that's really the, when you come west, there is this opening up to, you know, a lot more space. And so that's really how things got started, just by, like a lot of folks, going west as a young man.
Yes, that's right. And geez, like, I can't imagine going from New York City and these tall buildings and, you know, just the high density of people, and then going to Colorado and broad open spaces, mountains. I mean, was that a huge shift for you?
I always like to think of New York City and wild, the remnant wild, healthy ecosystems as being an equivalent, and that's that they're both very, very complex environments. So there's always something interesting to look at and to consider and think about, whereas the places that I have a little more problem with are the ones that have been homogenized, which is really what culture does. So you go to, you know, a suburb or farmlands, or a lot of what humans do is we bring things down to very simplistic structures. So New York is kind of a wonderfully complex place, and so you learn to look at things, and also wandering, it's, you know, neighborhoods as a kid, we were pretty much allowed to do whatever we wanted as long as we were home in time for dinner. And even by like third or fourth grade, we took the bus to school on our own. So there is a sense of going off and figuring it out for yourself that was granted to us as kids. And I think it's a different thing to be out here in a landscape, but there are equivalents of how you think and see the world.
Yeah. So what is it about the Southwest and the Southwest landscape that inspires you?
I think something, one of the things, it's starting to be fall, and I always remember in the fall is, a lot of the remote places would be flooded with people from, like, Germany, especially on their vacations, but there's still space here, and that's something that's obviously in my lifetime. You talk about Colorado College, I go back, and the Front Range is it's an interconnected, Western sprawl. I mean, there's very little open space, but I think the gift of public land allows us to still preserve some of that heritage for everybody, and that's really kind of a wonderful thing. So I think that that we still have public land. I mean, that's the greatest thing about the West.
Yeah, is it Acadia National Park and some of the smaller national forests maybe up in New England that really are sort of the closest to New York City of wildness or big expanses of public land, which in comparison to what we've got here are still pretty small.
Though there is something in New York, Central Park, which a lot of people hear about, or you see there'll be a concert there. But Central Park is a rather amazing park because it was, I guess, designed by Olmsted, and the idea of creating a large public space really for everyone to use was coming out of that idea of how do we design cities, how do people live together, what works best in communities. And one of the things I often point out about Central Park, and there's a certain irony to this, is that ecologically speaking, it's in a lot better shape than much of our public land. So even in the midst of a place like New York, there is these phenomenal landscapes. And I know recently in one of the little rivers in the Bronx, they found a species of leopard frog that no one had known about before. So there still are these things that have managed to hang on. But also in the East, when I was a sophomore in high school, again, parents were a lot more... lot shorter leashes for kids, but I had heard about this backpacking thing, and I, over the course of a year, got a sleeping bag, a pack, and a pair of boots, and pretty much worked for about a month to make a couple $100, and then just hitchhiked to North Carolina and spent the rest of the summer backpacking. And it really was that sense of, going off and exploring something. And, the first place we went was the Great Smokies, which... is in North Carolina, right at the spine of the Appalachian Mountains. And there are lessons there, is that this, much like much of our Western landscape, the Smokies has a few places, a few groves of trees that are old growth. And it really is the capacity of humans to use everything you see in the East, and really to get to the end of it, the either side of those ridges, you go downhill. And so it's the hardest place to get to, and so there are a lot of national forests along the Appalachians up in Maine, and there are public lands there, but it's not the not near as much as in the West, and it's not near as important to the larger function of the culture. I think public lands are something that we all use, and we all have a vision for how they should be used, and so. It's really part of our conversation here.
Right. So, when did you first pick up a camera? I don't think I know this, Michael.
When did I pick it up? I actually do know is that I got a Polaroid Swinger when I was in about seventh grade. And that was a cheap Polaroid. It cost about $20, which was fine as a gift, but then film was about $8. Which meant I used two rolls of film, and I don't know whatever happened to it, but I couldn't afford film for it. And then in high school, I once borrowed somebody's camera, and I remember that because if you learned how to do photography, you got a key to a basement room that you could lock, and as a high school student, there were certain advantages to that. So for a little bit, I learned how to do photography, but it really was never something... focal to anything I did. It was just It wasn't really until at the very end of my studies at Colorado College, I decided, you know, I listened to the bio and I go, well, that's really not quite true. Is that basically, I like to wander, and when I was in college, one course at a time meant that every 3.5 weeks you had a choice of what course you were going to take, and so I pretty much would just stick my head in a bunch of rooms and ask if the professor had any space left. I really wasn't paying a lot of attention, and second half of junior year, at that point you have to figure out a major, and I took a course from Jim Anderson on biology, and it was really quite wonderful, and at the end of it I asked him to if I could be a major, and he said sure, and that if I worked at it he'd help me get a job. So I forget where we're going with this, but
photography.
Oh yeah, photography. But so I did this, you know, biology degree, and basically at Colorado College, the reason Jim was so, you know, willing to offer a reward was you did pre-med biology. So I did 18 courses in a row that were pre-med biology, and you know, there's a certain rigor to that of you know, organic chemistry, analytical chemistry, physics, calculus, you know, physiology, cellular, molecular, all those things. And so I took one photo course in the one break I had where I couldn't fit in one of those courses. And in the end, when I finished it, because I like to finish things, I realized that the biology wouldn't allow me as much time outside, and the idea of photographing intrigued me. So it just, you know, when I had to make a decision, I thought, oh, I'll try photography.
So That's fascinating to me, and I wonder, you know, we've talked a little bit over the past, over your process in terms of going out into the landscape and taking photographs, and I wonder if you could explain that a little bit. You're not one to just launch right in and start snapping pictures. You really have to get out into the landscape. And
I think, you know, from what I'm saying, it probably comes across, and rightfully so, is that I really look at wandering as not this sort of abandoned kind of oblivious stumbling around, but really actually paying attention to what's available and choosing from things, possibilities of what you can look at, to really be attentive to things. So it's really a very focused way of paying attention to the world. And it's really what I love doing. So the land itself or complex environments are the most stimulating places to be. So my process is really I prefer to go and look at things. But then the nice thing about photography is it provides both a justification and a context. And the justification is when people ask you, what do you do? You know, and we need this kind of label. And so I can say, well, I'm a photographer and I'm working on this project. And you know, I spent a lot of time in sort of, you know, places where if you were just sort of showing up, people wouldn't be that welcoming. But if you're working on a project photographing, you know, the grasslands of northern Mexico, or sometimes out in some pretty remote ranch lands, that people are a lot more accepting. So the photography gave me a kind of purpose. And what I find is that something that it really interests me takes a long time to see. And often I'll look at something for, you know, 10 years or longer before I really begin to be attentive to make pictures. But I also, because I am a photographer and it's the work I've chosen, there are times in which I, you know, you got to do work and you have to produce, and you begin to focus in like, oh, I need to do something. And there can be a serendipity of it's time to work on a project, and then you begin to focus in.
We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Allison Civic, and we're talking today to landscape photographer Michael Berman. And Michael, you've written that art can help us navigate complex cultural, ecological, and political environments. And just maybe you can tell us how your work really achieves this.
I'm not sure if it achieves it. Let's just say it's a goal to try and navigate these ideas. But one of the things, and since we're in the political season, is that humans love stories. And they each community develops their own stories, and they often see them as, shall I use the word, gospel truth, that there's a real adherence. And that's actually part of the human brain, is the way we think is that we want to affirm those stories. And it's really hard to shift what people believe by coming up with facts. Actually, you know, what neuroscientists, they'll put somebody in a scanner where they can look at parts of their brains heat up. And what you find is when you give somebody facts that countermand what they believe, is they tend to cycle even more into what they believe and more against the sort of facts that are being thrown at them. And so I often think that it's really hard to convince somebody of something by just, piling, this is what's true, this is what you should believe. But I also think there are common points of reference. And I know, those people know my work and have heard me talk, as I'm not at all abashed about saying I'm an environmentalist, and I don't mind saying I'm a radical environmentalist, and I don't mind saying I'm a radical environmentalist from New York City. And I often will say that to people I meet, you know, ranchers or people who live out in these landscapes who are you know, very skeptical, if not hostile, to somebody who would take that label. But what I find is that if you start talking with people, not always, but often, you can find common ground. And I think that common ground is in seeing a landscape that either you're in love with, or a landscape that you find is quite beautiful, or something that's quite important, or something that you value. And what I do as a photographer is I'm trying to show people the landscape that's there. And that idea of seeing what's there, it's a long conversation I had with Charles Bowden. It's really what we're working on in these books. It's the same ideas. People prefer the stories to what's there. But black and white landscape is really considered old hat. It's sort of this fuddy-duddy kind of medium, which allows you to make these pictures and then introduce them into multiple settings. And people don't reject them out of hand. And again, people who've seen my work, it's a skill that I've developed over many years to make a beautiful photograph. It's something I can do. And I can do it to a landscape that people wouldn't always consider as, you know, like Yosemite or the Grand Canyon, where they're not going, wow, that's really incredible. But often people will look at my photographs and the first word that'll come to their lips is the word barren. And then they'll kind of realize, oh, I can't say this to the photographer. And then they'll go, beautiful, but they're beautiful. And so I think what I'm able to do, or try to do, is bring a vision of how these landscapes actually appear, and then allow people to access them through them being beautiful objects. And also, to me, they are beautiful landscapes. And I think then it's like a good story is rather than telling somebody this is what's true, if you tell them, you know, this is what I did out there, and you begin to laugh, or you begin to sort of empathize, or you begin to talk about places that people know, that you can get beyond the sort of rigid minds to a little more open to what actually is there and what's going on.
Yeah, I what strikes me about a lot of your photographs is patterns in the landscape, and the black and white imagery, I think, really sort of enhances a lot of these patterns that we see in nature. Have you always photographed in black and white, or have you ever done any work in color?
I've always photographed in black and white, except recently a friend has been trying to get me up to Wyoming for about 10 years now, and a funny conversation, he ended up getting me to go up there, and I just thought, well, I'm going to shoot, at least I have this fancy color digital camera, and I thought, well, I'm at least going to try it. So I have been making some color images, and they're quite beautiful. But what I decided, even in making them, is that no, I'm going to actually work digitally in black and white. And recently there's a camera that comes out that actually doesn't have any color capacity, and I thought, oh, I'm going to use that. And it's no reason other than that it's something I've learned to do, and it also fits in with this idea I have that right now the art of the last 100 years, it really has evolved around this idea of shocking an audience, or we need to always have something new. I think there was a phrase in the late 70s of the shock of the new to describe art of this century. And at this point in time, I find that the trying to shock people or trying to always have new ideas, it becomes as banal as, you know, working in a static way, and it's the same thing. So I have this idea that working within a traditional medium and using its using the parameters of it is actually more radical than trying to come up with the latest postmodern idea. And so black and white suits me just fine. And it's also, at this point in time, it's a much more complex medium in that, I use these fancy machines that I have no idea what's going on in the inside. I use my computer, and I also use film, and I also use chemistry. So it really is embracing old and new. And the prints I'm making now end up being a carbon-based ink on a paper, which is one of the oldest mediums. I mean, you know, 3,000-4,000 years old. With the Chinese working on, you know, carbon inks on paper. So it's a real old medium. So I kind of like that. And eventually you just have to sort of accept that you can't do everything, and it's good enough.
Some of your other works that I really love are when you combine your photographs and your website fragmented images. So you might fragment a photograph, but then combine that with pencil or charcoal and really drawing or painting with the images. And I think that they're just really some fabulous pieces that you've done. And what are you trying to do there with some of those?
I think that work came from allowing myself to discover what's possible with the work. And very early on, as a photographer, you complete a body of work. You know, you have a bunch of negatives, you have a bunch of pictures, and if you're fortunate, you have an exhibition, or maybe they get published somewhere. But there is this sort of question of, well, what do I do with this stuff? And I had this idea that, well, maybe I'll just cut up all my negatives and photographs and make something from them. And I began to make paintings and installations, and found that at the time I was doing that, in the late 70s, early 80s, it was quite interesting to curators that, you know, I would have this line about, oh, I work with a traditional black and white medium, and then I cut the negatives and photographs up and do installations. And the work was fitting within what was happening at that point in time, where you had a lot of artists in New York especially beginning to mix medias on painting. Art had come from this very restricted, formal, reduced minimalism and abstract expressionism that was beginning to explode to this, you know, East Village and Soho and all these things in New York. So it was kind of this idea of, like, you could be one tradition but another tradition. But there was a bigger thing for me, is that it actually followed a really natural cycle. And I think that's one of the things that's kept me healthy as an artist, is that's what happens with any living thing, is it starts out, you know, as a small seed of an idea. You begin to make stuff, it starts to grow, it gets larger, it gets big, and then you have to sort of wrestle it into some sort of form, and then you have this really tight form and it's done. And then what you do with it, you could put it in a box and save it, or you could begin to create another kind of soil for your next thing. And I found that I don't have lots of work lying around. So it's been a really healthy thing. And it often announces a new way to work or a new idea. And it also finishes the old idea. Like most living things have a cycle of life and death. And it's much healthier than trying to pretend like things should live forever.
You also collaborated with writers on a lot of your projects, like Charles Boden on Inferno, and Bill Broyles on Sunshot and your latest book, Gila, a compilation of essayists, 16 or so essays. I'm wondering sort of how is that process where you're collaborating with folks who specialize in the written word, and you're bringing these beautiful photographs to the work?
I think the Charles Bowden, and I also did a little thing that the Lannan Foundation put together of some images with poems by Norman Duby. And I remember when I did this with Norman, he said, well, as long as the writing and the images don't have a linear relationship, i.e., you know, you're not trying to tag a photograph with one of my poems or a poem to a photograph. And then it turned out he had written a poem that Dear Akimbo on a Fence that actually referred to a specific photograph, and we did have them together. And so there's a sense of rules and no rules, but really these relationships have often been one of people who work intensely, and then we go off and do our thing. So Bowden used to compare it with jazz, of laying down a riff, is that you'd write something and then have the opportunity of the other person to respond, but there never really was a literal response. It was more a sense of we were both working on similar ideas, and then, you know, we'd have these long conversations, but really we'd go off and do our own work, and we're looking for more complementary realms that were our own brought together, rather than complementing each other's work with something that's responding to it. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's kind of, certain artists are loners and certain artists like to work with other people, and I tend to be a pretty intense loner and work well with other loners.
We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Allison Civic, and we're talking today to landscape photographer Michael Berman. And Michael, I really want to congratulate you on your new book, Gila, Radical Visions, The Enduring Silence. And it's a gorgeous two-volume slipcase book of your photographs, along with essays by a variety of writers, including Charles Bowden, Dave Foreman, Sharman Apt Russell, Dutch Salmon, and Phil Connors. And the book is described by Marianne Redding in the foreword as a biography of the Gila. Tell us what your vision was for this book. What were you trying to accomplish or achieve?
Initially, it was just to get the book finished on deadline. That was the big thing. It was there are certain opportunities that you're presented with, and a couple years ago, I felt I had enough support to maybe try and do a book on my own and produce it. And I thought, you know, the Gila really is at a point in time where there's a lot in play, and we're really making decisions about what it'll look like in the next 100 years. And I thought it would be a good idea to attend to working here. So I talked to Marianne Redding, who I've worked with on several projects, and we came up with this idea, and Museum of New Mexico Press is one of the best presses around, and it's a little secret. It's a very small press, but it has a really great staff, and they're capable of doing these absolutely gorgeous books. So we had an idea, well, we'd pitch them on this and see what would happen, and we went into a meeting, we pitched them, and we were wildly successful in that we had a date of about 2 years, and they were willing to do a book, and there was some fundraising I had to do, and also I really didn't have the pictures that I wanted, so all of a sudden it went from being an idea to happening in a very short amount of time, and so it became this focus of mine for about 2 years to really work on it. So there is that level of nuts and bolts where all of a sudden I had this project to do. But there also was another thing, is I do talk about taking a long time before I photograph in a place, and often what I do is I move away and then come back to photograph. So I really photographed in Arizona after I'd left, same thing in Colorado, and on the Colorado-Utah border, is that I really came back to those places after I'd lived in them. But this is an area I'm very committed to stay here forever, as long as that is. And so it really seemed time to photograph. And I also do spend a lot of time up there and had noticed that many of the positive things that had happened in the 90s were beginning to fade, and that it seemed like a good time to remind people of what is up there and how beautiful and amazing it is. And really what I see is what's up there is it's one of the last complex ecosystems that's still functioning on the planet. And it's also an ecosystem that's capable of healing, and it really just needs to be left alone. And I had spent a lot of time in many other places, and this was the hardest one for me to figure out how really wonderful it is. So it was just time.
So how much time were you out wandering, and do you think, or did you really keep track of it?
I tend not to. I know right now I haven't. I've been in the studio for about 9 months. You have this idea, you do a book and you go out and photograph, but there's a certain point in time in which you're in the studio working on images, and then you're working on exhibitions. So I haven't spent any time out this summer. I hope once the fall comes, I always tend to get out then. But I was, during that period of time, any time I had over 4 or 5 or 6 days, I was trying to get out, and I was trying to get trips that were anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks, which in the past I would have considered that a short trip. But it really was, it worked well, because that's just about the amount of food I can carry. I can carry a camera and a tripod and a sleeping bag and just go up and off. And I found a lot of what was going on was that I was often leaving at 4 in the afternoon, and I'd get to the trailhead about 5 or 6, and then I'd walk for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. But I was doing my first day of hiking at night, and it was really quite wonderful because it gave me this time to decompress. And there also is an incredible attentiveness to walking at night especially if you find trails that aren't being overly maintained, is you really learn that you can actually feel the ground quite well and walk just fine if you don't use your eyes. And so a lot of these trips I was starting out in the dark, and I really began to like that way of hiking here. I'd always done that in the desert, but I'd never really hiked these forests that much at night.
So did you stay on trails? Were you kind of a bushwhacking kind of... Did you journey sort of off these trails?
I resist the word bushwhacking only because, you know, at its heart it implies that you're sort of blustering through, or, you know, bushwhacking. Maybe you have a machete and
right. You're
carving your way
true.
Through the mountain.
Very true.
And I think there's a level of like, oh, I'm just going to try and get through here. But what I was doing was often using a trail to get somewhere and then going off the trail for a couple days, whether a day or 3 or 4 or 5 days, to then tie it into somewhere else. And again, the Gila in places is a really remarkably healthy ecosystem. And what you find is that there are trails everywhere, and they're a little more nuanced. You know, they don't have a sign, they're not cleared, on either side.
Are they animal trails?
Yeah, they're
mostly
animal trails.
Okay.
There's a logic to landscapes. I was just up in Alaska this summer. My wife and I went on a little vacation, and what I found is that, you know, it's a really sort of, you know, dense forest. We're in this arboreal forest kind of area, and you can't see anything. And then I would go off for a walk, and then, you know, come back a couple hours later and maybe take Jennifer out and say, like, I had absolutely no idea where I went. And I'd notice I'd end up in the same places. But often the landscapes are pushing you and they're allowing you to move easier through one place than another. And there's a certain logic to moving through them. And as long as you're willing to embrace that I don't have to be anywhere in the next hour, or day, or 3 days, there's always a way you can get through these landscapes, and often you find they're game trails. I know there were several times when the hardest thing, I'd be on the steep sides up in the Mogollons trying to find a place to sleep, and it'd be getting dark, and I'd see, like, oh, that looks like that would be good, and then I'd get up to it, and it's a nice little round out place with three little bear turds in it. I'm like, ah, do I want to sleep there? And then I try and find another place, and it would be the same thing again. And you'd be kind of like, you know, this is the, these are the folks using these trails. It's, you know, the elk, the bear, the deer. And it's really kind of a wonderful way to move through a landscape. It's not, rather than saying I have to go a certain distance, but really just allowing it to open up and just see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Gila Wilderness is the nation's first wilderness area designated back in 1924, and our father of conservation, Aldo Leopold, was responsible for that. But describe for us the wildness of the Gila Wilderness that you've gotten to know through work on this book.
One of the There are lots of things. So there are a couple things that pop into my mind, but one thing that pops in my mind is the word pristine. And then in hiking in the Gila, I came up with another word, scraggly. And often people have this idea that a wilderness needs to be this pristine, hallowed place. And if you look at the history of wilderness, and it's still to this day, and listen to that word pristine, it's either thrown out there by, you know, enviros like me who just sort of use, well, everybody likes pristine, so I'll call it pristine, or it's almost always been used by people who are really against the concept and against protecting wilderness. In the beginning, much of the land that was taken out was people going, this is pristine, this isn't pristine, sorry, this isn't pristine, it can't be part of it. You can see another person here. And I think we've learned to see landscapes that way, and that's part of the photo heritage of people like, you know, especially Ansel Adams, who introduced us to a kind of beautiful wild landscape with black and white photographs that really were the big canyon, the tops of mountains, the great, you know, Mount McKinley, these great peaks. But what we've realized in the last 30, 40, 50 years is that it's more these less romantic, less grand landscapes that are really important parts of the ecosystem. And what I found in walking in the Gila is that word scraggly, is it's all over the place. Sometimes it's just these scruffy little oaks, sometimes it's hawthorn, sometimes it's grasses. Sometimes I think the one thing that's most remarkable is the ponderosa pines. And that was the thing I learned in Mexico, was I spent about 10 years looking for these old growth forests and realized the Gila is this last great ponderosa pine forest. And it isn't this one type of forest. It isn't, you know, those of you who know McKenna Park is the one of the most beautiful type ponderosa forest. It has these big trees and these open glades. It gets lots of fires. It's really healthy. But if you spend a lot of time up there, you know, up on Granite Mountain, the ponderosas are like little bonsai trees. Or you can go down in sort of the narrows of Turkey Creek, where you have in the bottom these incredibly dense, straight trees. But then as you go up the sides, they become these sort of dry, scraggly, thin trees. And that there really is this diversity, but also complexity, that it's not this one grand thing, but really a matrix of many, many different things. And it's learning to see how beautiful the smaller things are, rather than expecting, I need a visual shock and awe for this place to be important. Instead, realizing that maybe I need to learn how to see what's here and how beautiful it is.
We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Earth Matters. I'm your host, Allison Civic, and we're talking today to landscape photographer Michael Berman, whose new book, Gila, Radical Visions, The Enduring Silence, was released during the recent Gila River Festival. And one of the roles contemplated for your Gila book, Michael, was to raise awareness of Gila River, Gila wilderness issues, and to bring art and the environmental communities together in appreciation of the Gila, and perhaps act as a catalyst for raising awareness and funds for much needed support of various causes related to wilderness in the state. And I'm wondering if you could tell us how the Gila book is doing this.
Well, if I may say so, it's an absolutely beautifully made and done book. So it really does, I hope, present that vision of this as being a place that's quite wonderful. And it gets out in the world that way. The other thing that happens is, you know, just like this, people interview me at radio stations, or I do exhibitions, or I talk to people. So it's just an opportunity to share specifically the Gila, and then in a larger sense that you know, there are people concerned with wilderness, and it's a community that really has a voice, and a voice that I'd like to help get out there.
And you have been quite generous in making the Gila Radical Visions, the Enduring Silence, available, for instance, as part of the Gila River Festival, as part of a benefit to raise money for work for the Gila Conservation Coalition to protect the Gila River, the state's last free-flowing river. And I understand that you're going to be doing more of these fundraisers around the state, perhaps for other groups who are working on similar wilderness issues.
It's much like when I described that idea of a cycle of work, of that you resolve it and, you know, make all these beautiful images, but then cutting them up and making installations with them, is that I like to see the work go out in the world. So once you've done a book like this, and it really is quite beautiful, that I want it to be available. So I was able to get some support from some of the foundations in New Mexico, and I'm still not sure whether they want their names used. So I'm going to do a couple of benefits, and the first one was for the Gila River Festival and folks down here, which is really where it all starts. And generally I only do them for a day or two, because I actually make my living, and if I just give all my photographs away, then I'll be like Chekhov with, you know, sort of giving all your stuff away, and then you're not able to do anything. It doesn't quite work that way. But I also think it's really important that that people in the community realize that they're them that do and them that don't, and that there's usually just a few people who really carry the water and the weight on these issues for everyone else. And if you're not actually, you know, putting in time, which I don't see myself as doing, I see someone like you as doing a lot more of that work, is the money sure helps. And I know, since I'm on the board of several groups and I've been close to a lot of other groups, I know what UGWA and GRIP and GCC have done, and the amount of funding they get is amazing. There are very few groups nationally that can lay claim to as much, to both being as effective and also to being as well run, and to have doing it on so little resources. So I tried to make a few books, and I make some prints available, and to support these groups. And I really encourage everyone in every way to do the same thing. I mean, even a little bit of funding helps.
Well, Michael, we've certainly supported or appreciated your generosity. And for folks who maybe weren't able to participate in the Gila River Festival, you've got work up at Bear Mountain Lodge. Is that right?
That's right. Some of the photographs from the book are up at the lodge, and you can stop by and look at them. Now, that is the one thing, as an artist, you really want people to see the work. And I'd like to I think about the book just a little bit more, is that often when you do a book, there's lots of different visions for how a book will turn out. And the designer and I, David Skulkin is the designer, worked really closely together in this really wonderful way of just coming up with ideas and going with them. But in the end, it's a book that has very, very, very little text. I think somebody counted it and said there's 11 words on like the first two pages, and then there's no text or no numbers. And really what I wanted people to do was suspended the linear way of thinking and get a sense of what I see when I'm up there. And it's a really very primal, very primitive way of seeing this landscape, but it also is really quite wonderful, as if you're just sort of walking through, and every little place and everything has its own quality, and it's kind of amazing. And the book was was printed, and it's absolutely beautiful. Again, these things don't happen these days unless there's a lot of support. So there were a lot of people who put funding into this book, and several foundations supported it. So it really is rather amazing. And it's a little bit retro in that we did some things that were very traditional in terms of printing and design. And I know in the end we got one of the Thomas Palmer to do the duotones, and he's like the grand old master of making duotones, and did it in a very traditional old-fashioned way. And then
explain to us duotones.
Duotones. It used to be, in order to get a book, an image, black and white image printed in a book, if you just printed with black ink, you would just get this muddy black dark, and then the rest of the tones fall out. So they would take an image and break it into two tones, so you get duotone, and then eventually there's tritones and quad tones. But the duotone allowed you to print it with the black ink and then with a lighter gray ink, so you get a richer image. And it was the old way of doing things. Now there's a myriad of things you can do digitally, but it's still for the people who can do it, something that's quite beautiful. So we had this person work on it, and it was the same thing when David Skulkin actually went to Singapore to print the book. So he literally is on press, and he was working with this old guy who's worked at this press for like 30-40 years. So again, it's this sort of older vision, but it's really quite beautiful. And I know as an artist, it's really wonderful to see it printed well, especially black and white
right.
photo, which is most
it is beautiful. And the slipcase is absolutely gorgeous image and is this what is
that, just looking at, you know, Big Dry from
Big Dry. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Open to the Muggy Owens,
right? And all of the essays I found so interesting and fascinating and so personal and also very, very different.
Yeah, there was Marianne proposed this idea for the book, and the one thing I did have is I'm friends with Charles Bowden, and I went and talked to him and said, can I use your name? And I did a little prevarication of saying he was going to write an essay, which he did and had promised. But we had this idea of we would have multiple people write essays. And, you know, the first thing we thought about were who are the most famous people we can get. And in the conversation I had with Marianne, we really decided that we would look for something else. And we thought there were enough people out there who were personally connected and really cared about the Gila and would write something for us without getting remuneration, other than, you know, seeing this beautiful book and also aiding in bringing attention to the Gila. So we began to approach people, and I don't think anyone said no, I'm trying to think, but, and really what I ended up doing and what Marianne ended up doing with me is telling people just the really simple line is to write something from the heart. And we tried to get an arc of different things that were written, but that was our request. And then I decided not to read any of the essays till it was done. I read the first one or two and realized I'm way too close to this subject. And so...
Have you read them now?
I have. I read
you
them.
You read all of
as
them
as soon
now.
As I got it, I read
okay.
them all.
Okay, all
did.
Right.
I did read them. And it was wonderful. And there is this crazy arc to them. I know some of the people would be somebody I'd met. And then, I mean, one of the most surprising one is Jorge Garcia's. And when you do environmental work, it's a field that's overly dominated by white guys, and being a white guy probably can say that. And, you know, white guys aren't the most conscious folks in the world sometimes. They're like, why? Shouldn't we have the only opinion? But we're getting there. And so I had this idea, it needs to be a little bit broader. So I was looking for a greater spectrum of writers. And I met Jorge Garcia, and he's someone who had come from Mexico as a teenager as part of an Aztec dance troupe in this really, really incredibly small village. And he somehow parlayed that into a department in the University of New Mexico on Inter-American Studies. And I just mentioned, oh, Gila, you know, it's a great place. You want to write an essay, whatever, you're from Mexico. And I took him out for a hike in the Gila and stuff. And he said, let me get back to you. And a couple days later, I got this old, old map, and it had the five emergent places of the Aztec culture, and one of them was the Gila. So it's this incredible serendipity of, like, you know, I was just casting about, and, you know, with anyone and everyone, and all of a sudden it comes back to me is this great significance of this place that I've never heard that before, and I wasn't aware of at all. And so I think, you know, many things have started here. It's not just the idea of wilderness, but it's seen by people as an important place. And I think that's that, you know, if I had more time, I could have found a lot more essays. So I think people really care about this place and connect to it deeply.
So where else can people find your work? Do you have a current exhibit going on right now or upcoming?
I have in the 19th of October in Santa Fe. I have an exhibit at Scheinbaum and Russick. And also there'll be a book signing and a reading at the University of Santa Fe. And I'm also doing a...
What day is that? But around then in October?
It's all on this four-day period. I'm not the most oriented towards what day. I try and get myself someplace and then look and say, where do I have to be? And then there also is a benefit for New Mexico Wilderness Alliance and a concert that Renee Grimaud is doing, a really wonderful classical pianist. And so I'm going to speak, just as a little sideshow, I'm going to speak to some people about the Gila as part of that. So in Santa Fe next month, there'll be a bunch of events. And after that, I'm working on scheduling stuff.
Great. Wow. Well, so October's a busy month for you. And how long does the show run at Bear Mountain Lodge?
It runs until early part of October.
Early October.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Early October. Well, great. So, Michael, maybe you could tell us a story about the Gila River and some of your experiences out there when working on this book.
You know, not just working on the book, but one of the things I've done since I first come here is I always end up going back to the Gila River again and again. And I always try every year to walk from Grapevine through that 30-35 mile stretch through the wilderness that comes out at Turkey Creek.
Right.
And I remember pretty much near the end of the book, I did walk the river, and often when I do these hikes, I'm not really that into hygiene, so I remember one time I got out of the river at Turkey Creek, and Jennifer, my wife, was going to pick me up, and I was sitting next to the road, and I stood up, and she actually backed the car up and started running away, or driving away from me. I had to sort of wave at her and go, no, no, it's me, it's your husband. So I get a little bit, you know, you have one set of clothing, but I remember the last time I walked down the river, I was maybe 2-3 hours from Turkey Creek, and I thought, well, and it was a beautiful day, it was really hot, and I got to this pool that had this pyramid of a rock sticking up in the middle of the pool, and I thought, maybe I'll just take a bath. And I've gotten so, I'm a desert guy, I really don't, water's kind of cold, you know, but I was like, I'll take a bath and clean myself up. So I threw my pack on the side, and then I put all my clothing on this little pyramid of a rock, and I went in the water, and I'm swimming around for about, you know, just about a minute, and this, you know, I noticed this big gust of wind that came up. I didn't pay a lot of attention to it, and then I look up at where the water's coming out of this pool, and I see this strange thing, and I go, oh, that's my shirt. So I go running and grab my shirt, and then I look at the rock, and I'm going like, oh, my pants, all my clothing, and it was all gone. So I spent about the next hour trying to figure out, like, the trauma of, like, you know, the wilderness is that, you know, what do I need here? I don't really need anything, but I'm thinking, like, I got to hitchhike when I get out of here. So I'm like, maybe I can wrap my tent tarp around me and all this kind of craziness. But it really was that sense of that, you know, I didn't really need a lot when I'm up in the woods, and it was really amazing to walk through these places. But there is always a trauma of, you know, of our culture of, like, oh, I can't act like this. I can't walk around naked. I can't, like, do all these things. But somehow up in the woods, you can just sort of wander around, look at things, and be like a child once again. It's a really amazing world out there. And the Gila River is something that, when I first came here in the 90s, it wasn't in very good shape. And that stretch of water had virtually no recruitment of trees, and most of the riparian was pretty much gone from overgrazing. And a part of the community really questioned that and called the Forest Service and other parts of the community to task to remove the cattle, and it did recover. We were told it wouldn't. And it's really just this amazing, beautiful, beautiful river. And it, that we'll lose that again unless people really decide it's what they want and it's important. And so, you know, the river, you know, doesn't need us as much as we need the river.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you for being on our show today, and thank you for this beautiful gift of the book Gila, Radical Visions, The Enduring Silence. For those of you who'd like to check out more of Michael's work, you can go to his website at fragmentedimages.com. If you'd like more information on how to obtain a copy of his latest book, Gila, Radical Visions, The Enduring Silence, please go to the Gila Conservation Coalition website at gilaconservation.org. Michael, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.